Hey there, listeners. The anime episode Sympathy for the Devil contains violent and graphic imagery that we cover in today's episode. Please listen with care.
Hello, I'm Lauren Fates, and betrayal comes easy to me.
And I'm Jamie Sanchez. I live by iron codes of honor.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome, everybody, to another week of the Bebop Beat. We're so glad to have you listening to us. And this week, we're back with our regular episode rotation. If you were around last time, you got to hear our great, super cool interview with Steve Conti. And now we're talking Sympathy for the Devil. I, for whatever reason, did not have this episode resonate with me in my previous watches, and I was very affected this time. But before we get to that, Jamie, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. It's been a week already. And yeah, I would also agree with you. This episode hit me in a way, in just a new, different way that I had never experienced before. So I'm really jazzed to talk about it.
Jamie, hit us with this week's news or announcements.
Past guest Lauren Orsini from episode 4 reached out to us to let us know that there is an awesome fan video out there. It's titled Cowboy Bebop Episode 00 Midnight Rambler. It can be found on YouTube, and it is like high production fan video. It features Spike primarily going after a syndicate or past syndicate connection. There's lots of really great martial arts abilities. That's pretty much the highlight of the video. And, you know, it's a good 5 or so minutes to watch. Please buckle in for that. It was highly enjoyable. I'm so glad it was produced. It gives fan videos a good rep.
I did get a chance to watch that, and I love the fight choreography. I loved the look of Spike and Jet, just the physical styling of them. The lighting was very cool. I was expecting to see like a Faye cameo or something and was a little disappointed. I don't think really there were any women in this one, but there was a cameo at the end that I won't spoil for you all.
But yeah, I think it's just really cool that folks are still so excited about the show, especially with the Netflix adaptation coming up. And this is very clearly the homage, like, hey, maybe you could tap us for the Netflix show. We're great at martial arts. I would love to see them as cameo characters, honestly.
Speaking of YouTube videos, since our music episode, I've been looking for more information about music in Cowboy Bebop on YouTube. And there's another pretty new video called Jazz Pianist Reacts to Cowboy Bebop Soundtrack. It's just a cool like analysis by a real legit musician about the songs of Bebop, a real love letter to the music. It does have a super clickbaity headline. The screenshot is a picture of the guy making the like classic YouTube face, like, and across the screen it says plagiarized. Like,
oh my,
was this music plagiarized? It clearly like wanted to get some scandal clicks, but it's actually not a hit piece. I clicked it and I was ready to be angry, but it's just like a real nice chat with a real nice music guy. So I recommend that YouTube video as well.
I'll definitely check that out. So Lauren, in the several weeks we've been producing this show, we have been using a load of internet resources for our research. And one of those resources that comes up frequently, and we've discussed on the show previously too, is a website called jazzmess.com, short for Jazz Messengers. Well, I'm pleased to introduce our guest today, Mary Strasser, the founder of jazzmess.com, also an engineer and artist, and has been so gracious to join us on today's show to discuss the episode. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Jamie. I'm happy to be here.
So, Jamie, how did you find Mary, if you're willing to share? Because I think you did some detective work.
I did. There aren't many fan websites from the old days around anymore. My collection of old links are just really defunct and sad. There's a lot of just 404s or, you know, just websites that have gone unrenewed. So Jazzmez.com being one of the few left, I was like, what if I put this into Twitter? And I did come across some of Mary's tweets, and I was kind of like, is this actually the person? And they say they're going to update the website. I'm just going to poke this beast here. So thank Twitter. It is kind of scary what you can find on it when you put in some stuff in advanced search. But I'm so glad we can make this connection and to meet you today.
That's fun. I was wondering how you found me myself. I didn't think to ask, but yeah, that's good. It was Twitter. Okay.
Yeah. I also noticed in one of Mary's emails that she said, I can prove that that's my website if you want. And it didn't even occur to me that somebody could lie about that. It's made me paranoid about all guests past and future. Was that really Steve Conti?
So, Mary, would you like to give our listeners an introduction to the website? Like, what is jazzmess.com and why did you decide to name it such?
All right. So the Jazz Messengers is the website that I came up with in response to my really strong feelings of fandom for Cowboy Bebop. I really liked the show. I was somewhat obsessed with it back then. So I wanted to have a website. I didn't feel like there were that many out there at the time. And I wanted one that was really comprehensive, especially in terms of the music. I went to music school. I was in music school at the time and loved the music, wanted to know what all the songs were, wanted at least there to be some place that if someone wanted to look up a song, they could. So that was my website. So the Jazz Messengers were a jazz collective that were active, I believe, from the late 40s to maybe the 60s or 70s. I don't know their exact dates, but by jazz collective, that means that they had at different times, different people came into the group, different people left, but it was still the Jazz Messengers, even if you had entirely new different people. It's actually kind of similar to how the band The Seatbelts is, in that they have different sections that come in and out. There are people in Paris, there are people in New York. So all the songs that you hear on the soundtrack are different, come from different places. So the Jazz Messengers themselves, and the reason I like that idea is because, first of all, I know that the theme, the Jazz Messengers, comes up in Cowboy Bebop itself. I don't actually know if it's in the show. I think it might be an art book that mentions them as the Jazz Messengers. So that's Spike, Faye, Jet, Ed. Those are the Jazz Messengers in terms of the show. So it felt like a nice, like I'm talking about the characters, I'm talking about the music. So this was a nice title that tied that all together.
So what attracted you to Cowboy Bebop that made you want to do this? And why do you think people still love Cowboy Bebop decades later?
Well, the first thing that attracts you, I think it attracts everybody, and it definitely attracted me, is that opening theme, right? Everybody loves that music. Everybody loves the graphical elements of that opening. There's nobody who watches that who isn't instantly hooked on it, right? The show, I think, what brings you in after that? Like, once you see the opening, what's the next thing? The things in the show are, the style is fantastic. The music is great. It's not just that it's good music, which Yoko Kanno, you know, Yoko Kanno is always going to be great, but also that the visuals marry to the music so perfectly. It's like the best music video ever, but it also has a story. So that part all brought me in. That sucked me in. And characters for me is always like the big thing in any story that I'm watching. And this show has characters in spades. So I would say those are all the reasons that I liked it, that I stayed. Those are also all the reasons that it continues to have longevity. It continues to make people care about it. You get start with that first, you know, bright, shiny candy of hook of tank, and then everything else keeps you going.
Part of the reason I was so excited to connect with you is, you know, both Lauren and I have experience with early Bebop fandom as well. And you had provided this very influential website among a group of other people who were doing very similar things back in, you know, the early aughts when Wikipedia wasn't really a big thing. It was hard to Google stuff. So having fan circles and things like the Bebop boards around for fans to connect and share their, their love of the show and their findings and analysis of the content. It's just so great to have that perspective. Do you have any interesting stories about maybe how your website had impacted the fandom or the kind of content you had on it early on?
Interesting stories from back then. I don't feel like my stories are that interesting, but I will say that I got to sort of know Elizabeth Weaver, who you may or may not recognize that name. So we both chatted on the same Bebop forum. I sent her fan art. She sent me fan art. It was really great. Now I know she had a comic recently just completed. She's like a big, great shining star. So my big story is that I got to know her on a personal level. And then, you know, she went on to continue to do amazing things.
So to give a little bit of context, I love E.K. Weaver. She's been an illustrator in the industry since the early days of Bebop. She created the comic The Adventures of TJ and Amal, and that's published through Iron Circus Comics here in Chicago. I think it's really awesome that early on she would attend conventions. I had the chance to meet her in person and commission her for a portrait of Vicious before he was crazy.
Of course, Jamie, I did.
this is so me. And so that's like been in my Bebop display case for over a decade at this point. It's one of my favorite pieces. And EK is such an amazing artist.
And can I say her website, her Cowboy Bebop website, also still up.
Yeah. Big truck. If you want to see some of that early influential Bebop fan art, it's still there. And that's awesome.
How has your website changed over time? Because it's been a while.
It has. But at a certain point, I did stop updating it. There was really only one big design change that I did. It originally was like, there's a somewhat famous art piece of the Cowboy Bebop crew. It's sort of got Spike, Jet, Faye, Ed, Ein, all squeezed into a frame. And Jet and Spike are sort of looking really annoyed, and everybody else is sort of excited, I think. I think Faye is also annoyed. You may or may not know the picture I'm talking about. I used that as sort of my template. I had cut it up a little bit. That was my template for the original website. When I did the redesign, I actually drew a digital picture and then used that as the focus of my design. It's also somewhat, I mean, it's dated. The design now is dated. I have not updated it. I will say that it reflected my ideas back then of web design, which were, there was all these different websites that had all sorts of things happening on them. There were flashing things and people had meta titles that flashed and they had GIFs. And my feeling was, no, that's all ugly. Make it clean. And that's what I did. It's not responsive to mobile now. So that's one of the reasons why it's outdated.
It's certainly timeless, though, I would say.
Thank you.
So how do you feel about maintaining one of the last functional Cowboy Bebop fan sites out there?
I don't really have, I don't think about it that much. I just, at the time, I had feelings about the internet back then, about what the internet was. And I felt it was a very impermeant source. If you put your art on there, it's only going to be up there a few years and then it's gone. And I didn't like that. I was like, if I'm going to make this, I want it to be there. I want it to be like I built the house. The house is here now. And I know even houses eventually crumble, but I was like, as long as I can have it, I want it to be there because I made it. So that's why I continue to hold it up. I actually didn't think that there were that many people who noticed it. I just thought it was something there for me. So that was my feeling about it. It's my house that I built and I want it to be still sitting.
That's a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah, that just warms my heart. One of the questions I was really interested in was if you ever looked at the analytics and saw who's visiting now. But it sounds like no, it sounds like maybe that doesn't matter.
I looked because of the question. I did look because of this podcast and I did not find any real answers. It was all spiders. It was all web searches. So people are searching images and they're finding my images and that seems to be pretty much it. I do get messages occasionally, very rarely, but just every now and then someone will send me a message and say, I'm glad that this website is still up, basically. But that's pretty rare, like a couple of times a year, maybe. Yeah.
I want to say of my large pool of old Bebop links, it's like your website and like a Lynn fan shrine that's still out there.
Just a fun, irrelevant fact for listeners at home about your podcast host. I'm arachnophobic. And I'm so deeply, viscerally arachnophobic that just you saying it was a bunch of spiders.
I'm so sorry.
Even for a split second, I was like, whoa, ew, what? And oh. I'm surprised by that level. I did not realize that just the word would send me to a place. It's not even, it's a tech term. What is wrong with me? So, okay. Good times.
I should have said bots. I'm so sorry.
No, I never would have warned you. I had no idea that was coming. I didn't know that was in my heart. We all learned something just now. All right. Sympathy for the Devil. We have here a pretty famous standalone episode. A lot of sci-fi concepts, but also maybe some spiritual concepts, depending on who you are. This episode starts out with a jazz harp playing. I think that's just a harmonica. Maybe I'm wrong, but we see lots of weird imagery. There's goop and fish and eyeballs and needles and doctors. Eventually, we see that Spike is kind of dreaming these things. He's hallucinating while listening to this live concert. Cut to the Bebop itself, where Ayn is hungry. Dog food is the last thing in the fridge, and Faye eats it just to have a moment between those characters. And then back with Spike and Jet, they are chasing two bounties named Giraffe and Zebra. The thing is, all is not what it seems with Giraffe and Zebra. This episode has a big twist in it. We're not actually chasing our adult characters at all. So before we get too deep into it, Mary, what is kind of your high level hot take on this episode? Are you a fan? What do you think?
You both said that it affected you more, and I would say that affected me more than it did back in the day. I still am not like super into this one. It's not one of my favorites, but I feel it's more like a fable, and it's more, this has definitely got heavy foreshadowing of the ending, which I somehow missed the first time around. But there's a whole scene that's almost a copy of what happens at the end. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that's more about the characters we're with than it is about the characters who happen to be transplanted into the episode. That's what I would say.
I think that is a great observation. This one lived in my memory as just like a standalone story with some people we were never going to see again. But you are absolutely right. Even down to the conclusion, the last couple of lines of this one, there's a lot more that ties into the lore than maybe I realized. Jamie, what do you think?
I've always seen this one as a substantial episode for our main characters, but not necessarily the bounty of the week. It's very clear that this particular bounty, or at least the dying wish of the bounty, makes a big impact on him. He's already like entered the episode not quite in his usual state of mind. And we learn fundamental things about him, right? That he, his eye is cybernetic. We also learn that he can say sorry and mean it. And we also learn huge things about the world itself, this universe, and what has happened to Earth, right? And that's just so much backstory that really lends itself to pretty much every other Bebop episode. Why we're in space, how the gates work, just kind of society's reactions to it, and where the hell is Earth in all of this?
Yeah, I'm glad you're diving so early into Spike, because this is a very heavy Spike episode. In fact, one of my favorite scenes that we've seen so far in our rewatch of Bebop up until this point is that first scene with Jet and Spike. They're using those tech glasses again to track the bounty. And Jet is talking about how much he loves jazz. And they're kind of having this buddy-buddy joke back and forth moment. a very famous quote from the dub is in there, in which Spike says, "A baby hipster, very cool." I've seen like fan t-shirts with that on it. The sub actually just says, "You were a very thoughtful kid," which is cute and still a cute relationship builder, but is not nearly as funny and weird as the dub.
One of my favorite lines actually comes from Jet this episode, where he's like, "I have a gift for you," to Faye. And Faye is just like, hook, line, and sinker. "Yeah, I want that gift. Give it to me." And it turns out to be this invoice for her stay on the Bebop. And then Ayn walks into frame to twist the knife from earlier.
Well, Ayn gets his food eaten, so I think he can have a little comeuppance as a treat. It's fine. The relationship with Faye is bizarre in this episode, because you can tell she has gotten a lot more comfortable and she's gotten a lot more at home than maybe the people around her were willing to do or were ready for. She's walking around in like her pajamas, eating the last bits out of the fridge. And that's actually where our intro at the beginning of this episode comes from. She's really buddy-buddy with Jet, and Jet takes this moment to say, like, women are traitors. Women betray easily. They clearly don't trust her. Unlike men, you see, of course.
I'm really happy you brought up that line, because it struck me a certain way this time. I didn't really notice it that much the first time around, for probably because I didn't notice sexism at all much back then. But it struck me this time because he's talking to Faye, who was betrayed by a man, and he's best buds with Spike, who did betray his buddy. So he's in his own life, he's got a woman who was betrayed herself by a man and a man who was a betrayer. So he's like, it follows the theme that happens in a lot of episodes, which is things are not what they seem. And this is a big one about things are not what they seem. Things are not what they seem. You got to look deeper. There's more going on.
I absolutely love that you brought that up, because that note is actually in my notes too. I have, quote, "But men live by iron cones of honor." And my anecdote is, tell that to Spike.
It reminds me of every day on the internet as a woman, frankly, where we're just constantly told how emotional we are and how reactive we are, and constantly like tone policed when evidence points to, hey, men, you're also problematic.
So part of what makes this episode so interesting is Wen's appearance, right? So this is the first antagonist we've seen so far that isn't vicious, that legitimately scares Spike. And even with Spike's abilities, Wen appears to be a really good shot. He has that like very visceral, just vicious energy behind him. You can tell there's that same kind of psychosis almost borderlining there. Apparently, he also has so much melatonin that it cures gunshot wounds applied directly to the forehead.
We get a lot of terrifying imagery of Wen, you know, a bullet in his forehead, him standing before these hellish flames. But the whole point of him is that he doesn't normally look like that. He is this wide-eyed, adorable child on the outside who lives with a supposed parent in a wheelchair. And for at least a short time at the beginning of the episode, we think maybe he is a hostage to our bounty. I can't recall if as a teen I bought into that. I think I probably did, though. I think they sell it pretty well. And I think it is a surprise. As a giraffe dies, he says he needs help now, help him. And he says things like, "Let him go, Zebra." And we think he's talking about the child, but he's talking about Zebra himself. Wen has spent years, decades, in fact, just sort of leeching off of these guys in wheelchairs who he injures himself. I think he actually puts them in the wheelchair, which is so scary, to keep up the facade that he's just some poor musical savant kid.
The question then becomes, why does one even need a guardian, I guess, for the act, especially since he has this local fame as a renowned blues harpist?
Yeah, I think he's supposed to sincerely look really little. Like, it wouldn't be okay for him to be walking around without a chaperone. It's sometimes hard to tell, especially with like 90s dub voice acting, how old little boys are supposed to be, but I think he's supposed to be real little.
In the reference material I had been looking at, Wen is aged at 12. So there's clearly some kind of conflict there. I think a 12-year-old could get around just fine in this universe without a chaperone.
You think so? I imagine there were still like laws.
I mean, he's smart enough. I think he could do it.
What would he tell people? Like, people are nosy. Like, let's just think about real life. This kid's walking around Target, Space Target, or Space Walmart. Someone's gonna be like, little boy, where's your adult? Over and over and over. Ironically, the one time I went to Japan, I was in my mid to late 20s. And a family from another country asked me where my mother was and how was I flying internationally without my mom. This happens.
I think if we're going to try to bring it in the real world, I think Wen could probably just tell people that he has a condition. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I'm going to say, for plot reasons, I mean, I would say that maybe it's more like he gets more from his act by being this 12-year-old genius than he would be if he were an adult playing this well. It's possibly a money thing. That's what I'm going to say on that.
I would agree with you, too. I've been watching the show this time with my partner, and we're constantly like, hey, how does he know what taxi cab that is? And hey, how does so-and-so know to be there? And it's just like, I don't know, kind of strange writing.
I like what you're saying, though, about this being maybe more of an aesthetic choice than a necessity one. I was certainly giving the benefit of the doubt that a child just needs a chaperone. But Wen is written to be very creepy and very sadistic, and it would not surprise me if it's just what he enjoys is tricking people like this. It just makes him seem more cartoonishly evil, frankly. So a little more about our bounties that we learn throughout the episode. Giraffe is wanted for 3 million Wulong for murder. Both Giraffe and Zebra worked at Sakai Co. They participated in the gate protest movement and made it to the top ranks of the National Defense Volunteer Corps, where they met some other folks. I think the guy who is Jet's contact, Fatty, I think he knows them through their history in protest and military and such as well. But they're directly tied into what you were talking about earlier, Jamie, which is kind of the disaster that more or less wipes out the Earth.
Yes. So a little bit more context about the gate explosion. You learn this episode that there is an astral gate on the moon. Wen and his parents are in Prairie Land, and when this explosion occurs, and you have these really bright, beautiful streams of light that are not unlike the CG effects in a hyperspace gate. And it's a pretty sad story overall, that is portrayed very similar to other sad stories in anime, particularly stories about atomic bombings, such as that in Grave of the Fireflies. I see a lot of parallels in that flashback sequence to shows like that and movies like that. Other things to note about the Astral Gate that isn't explicitly stated in this episode, but can be found in art books and interviews, things of that nature, is that it exploded in the year 2022. So enjoy that next year, in case we didn't have enough to worry about. The gate explosion killed over 4.7 billion Earthlings, causing humanity's numbers to decline to 1.5 billion and became the biggest catalyst for Earthlings to colonize Mars and the solar system. because Earth was no longer habitable. The other interesting assumption here that the fandom has brought up on occasion is that the explosion likely happens in the Western Hemisphere, therefore leaving the Eastern Hemisphere relatively untouched, which is why the crew can explore a city like Singapore later on. But yeah, it's a pretty grim situation overall. I could see reasons for the gate protests happening and people being upset about this.
That also puts a really dark spin on a question we asked earlier this podcast, which was, why is there a Chicago, Illinois, Japan? Frankly, if I were to like hypothesize, right, maybe after this huge disaster, places started to be named in memory of places that were lost.
That's super dark. This whole episode is gonna haunt me.
It's dark, but it could be.
It's my new nightmares.
One of the things I really love and appreciate about this whole bit of lore, though, is how much of it is only theorized by our characters. Jet is quite intelligent. He comes up with this entire theory about hyperspace energy by just sort of analyzing this ring that they get. You already said sort of the chemical component of it, Jamie, but Jet's theory gets into circadian rhythm. I think it's a really big sci-fi stretch, honestly, because I know people in real life who have disorders of the circadian rhythm, and it doesn't stop them from aging. They just have unfortunate and sometimes damaging sleep patterns, but they're still out here getting older. So I appreciate the swing this episode takes. But a question that I'm left with is this actually correct in the Cowboy Bebop universe? Is this what happened to Wen? Or is it a bad theory on Jet's part because it's bad science in real life? And Wen is something else, maybe something more supernatural?
I'm going to input here. I think that he made the right call. I mean, obviously he did because it worked out. Whether it's actually, I think the whole thing, I think I said it earlier, is more like a fable. This is the magic ring that's going to destroy the demon. That's what that is saying. It's a little bit of what they call in Star Trek, technobabble, you know? Because I take melatonin to go to sleep sometimes. The overdose of melatonin is not going to make you immortal. it's still just a matter of he's got the magic bullet. Spike's standing there. He's got the gun. He does the... It's all about... That's why this whole episode is very much fable to me. I will say there is one invention. There is one sci-fi element that back then, in 2001, I was like, oh, come on, that's never going to happen. And then in subsequent years, they actually came up with it. And I was like, wow, I guess I was wrong. And that is the device that Alpha Catch, mm-hmm. that he puts on his head and he sees his dream. We don't have anything that direct yet, but we do have the ability to take people's thoughts and put it on video to a degree, very small degree. But the fact that we can do it at all says it's possible someday to me.
I love that you mentioned the Alpha Catch because Jet also labels it this piece of crap.
I thought that was super funny because we see so much weird tech on the Bebop. We already mentioned those ID glasses are back. There's the Alpha Catch. And there's also whatever chemical analyzer they put the ring in. And it's all just sitting around the Bebop in a way that doesn't seem sterile or cared for. It is really just treated like this garbage that they have.
I mean, look at the supercomputer in your hand and see how dusty it is, and you'll understand. I mean, I understand that part of it perfectly. My screen is so dusty. I get it. That part I get.
That's true. I tweet about this often because it's one of my favorite things that I ever heard. But I have a friend who said, we're already in the cyberpunk future. It's just boring. And I believe that even as I get ready each week to record this podcast, because I literally shove one computer aside to throw down another computer to like talk to my friends on video. And I'm definitely treating all the technology in that process as if it's just like a piece of sports equipment or a toothbrush in the bathroom that I'm just like, get it out of here.
I also appreciate Jet's. He's such a handyman, and somehow he's also a geologist in this episode, or a gemologist, and he can transform the ring into a fancy bullet that can then be shot safely into a skull of an undying 60-year-old that looks like a 12-year-old child. Like, this, a stretch is generous, Lauren. I think this episode just goes way over the top.
We definitely use Jet in this series, I think, as a catch-all for, like, when we need a special skill or a special expertise that falls out of the other archetypes. Like, knowing mineralogy or geology could never be a Spike thing. It could never be a Faye thing. Ed's not here yet, and I would argue that probably wouldn't be an Ed thing either. So Jet knows it. We give it to Jet.
But here is the million-dollar question. Would it be an Ein thing?
Ooh. I bet it would be. We just don't know how to ask him.
Yes.
Okay, so I guess I'm going to die on this hill a little bit, because I really like speculating that there are things in Cowboy Bebop that can't just be explained by science. And Cowboy Bebop wants us to think about that. We know they do, because we've already talked in earlier episodes about the sort of luck elements, the fortune-telling elements, the sometimes shoddily handled Native American sort of spirituality analogs we have going. I think Bebop sometimes wants us to look beyond the explainable. And I want to point you both towards the sub versus dub difference when Wen finally reveals himself. The order I always watch this in when I'm doing my research is I watch the dub first and the sub second. That was a really big deal this time, because in the dub, Wen says, "I was alive when this place was an outpost, before the asteroids were even settled." And like, okay, that's a really long time, but that is conceivable in the timeline of the show, especially because we're given an exact year when the explosion happened. However, in the sub, he says, "I've been alive since the days when humans crawled only on the face of the earth." Like, crawled like proto-human caveman stuff. And I really think the sub was trying to go for a more like, either he's actually the devil or he's starting to believe that he is the devil. And maybe it's the latter. Maybe it's just the insanity, but that's in there. The episode is called Sympathy for the Devil. We see him standing in front of fire. And I think the episode wants us to ask that. Is he something else?
Given his past trauma, I would not doubt that he is partially off the deep end, for sure. You know, living through such a horrendous event. He also is treating people like tools. He just straight up kills a taxi driver for no real reason. He throws Zebra down the stairs as a tool to prevent Spike from chasing him. Like, these are not things that sympathetic humans would do. So for you to claim that he is in some sort kind of a demon or a devil, or and then also marry your theory that, you know, this is a fable and that the hero comes with the gem to appropriately put down this devil and make things right again in the world. Like, all of these themes culminated, at least in my sense, to really appreciate this episode more. And you're hitting on themes that I don't think I could have articulated, but now that you have, make perfect sense to me.
I'm going to remain the skeptic in terms of the spiritual element, because I always feel like Bebop, no matter how supernatural something seems from the start, always turns out to be something mundane. So I do believe that Wen is an actual human child, or was a human child who was infected with some disease and that made him hard, very difficult to kill until Spike came along. I I do see what you're saying in terms of the spiritual element of cowboy bebop. There definitely is one there. I just don't think they ever go that hard into it. I think at the end of the day, it remains a sci-fi series with some fantastical elements.
I'm willing to buy that. I mean, I'm a huge Dana Scully fan. I'm always here for the person who says it can all be explained. I just want to point out a couple more things for the listeners at home to chew on. One is Wen gets shot in the head earlier on in the warehouse, and there is so much blood on the ground. And just from blood loss, it's wild that he lived, in my opinion. The massive car crash explosion, not only does he live through that, but he's not damaged in any way. And it might just be an animation thing, but he's not like maimed at all. But I was also really intensely affected by the scene in which Wen's parents die. Wen emerges from under the horrific charred corpse of his parents who were over him, protecting him. And I just have a hard time buying that his parents just like holding him in a specific way somehow managed to save him from a disaster that killed billions upon billions of other people. It doesn't seem like something a normal person should live through. And so I am willing to buy there was some scientific reason for it. Maybe it wasn't because he was secretly a demon kid. I think that's on the table as well. But I'm not sure it's fully explained in this episode. I think it's left a little bit mysterious on purpose.
That's true. Cowboy Bebop does that a lot. And that's one of the things that I like about it. It gives you a hint of what the real story is, but it doesn't try to explain it fully for you. It wants you to come up with the answer. And that's also one of the reasons I think it's lasted so long as a series, because it doesn't over-explain things. It doesn't tell you every single corner. It wants you to look and see what you think the answer is. For me, the answer is, I think it's probably explainable within the universe. For you, the answer is maybe there is something supernatural that happened in that moment. Both work. Both are correct. It doesn't need any more explaining. I don't want to know the answer from the creators. I want it to remain that way.
It is a through line in the show where just, is it bad writing or is it just cut for time? Or are they trying to be a little mysterious? And I think in regards to this is an anime of the late 90s. The show's phenomenal. It really changed what anime was like in that time, and it was very impactful. But in terms of, is this a complete narrative? Does it need to be? I think we can leave that up to interpretation. I do really love the potency of Wen's character, the terrifying aspect to him that he's immortal and he's unhinged and he could potentially kill Spike. And for some reason, this is the first time Spike is really resonating with that terror.
On a more lighthearted note, because we've spent so much time here in Grimdark Town, there's a dub sub difference that tickled teenage Spike Faye shipper Lauren, and that is in the dub, Spike refers to Faye as dear. He's like, yes, dear, as he's trying to leave. And I don't think that affection is in the sub. I also think the line delivery, even by Wendy Lee, when she's basically telling Spike that he's not coming back, I think it's a little bit more sympathetic in the dub. I have to wonder if somebody on the dub crew somewhere wanted to plant a relationship there.
I have that interaction in the dub and the sub different. I actually find her saying goodbye to Spike to be insincere, and then her moment on the ship's deck where she says all men are idiots in Japanese, it feels more desperate, and you can hear some sorrow in her voice at that moment.
I guess the question is the sorrow over maybe losing Spike, or just the fact that nobody ever seems to listen to her when she's being completely reasonable?
Good point. I can agree with that one, too.
Mary, do you have any bebop ships?
Well, I will. I don't actually, because I feel like it's almost incestuous to put Spike and Faye together, because they are like, they're a created family. Jet is 150% the mom. Spike and Faye are brother and sister. Ed is a little sister. There can't be any ships. No ships.
A lot of the fandom agrees with that. I think you're on the majority side of the fandom there.
I would say about Faye's lines, I don't remember the sub. I didn't listen to the sub for this podcast, but I don't feel like at this point in the series that Faye is close enough to the boys yet to actually feel strongly about this. That's why there's such a difference between how she reacts in this episode and how she reacts in the finale episode, where there's a parallel scene where it's way different. She's attached in that final episode. In this episode, she's just like, I don't want to see you go die. Don't just die for nothing. Like, she sort of feels something, but it's not strong. And maybe it is about her life of always losing people that seems to happen to her a lot.
It does. We haven't seen Faye's background story revealed yet, and we won't for a while. But how much does it suck to wake up after so many years asleep and just be dealing with the same abandonment issues and the same loss issues? Poor Faye.
Yes.
I will say, just as a personal opinion, the CGI of Wen aging and dying looks very silly to me now, but I bet it looked awesome in the 90s. I bet that was a huge achievement back then.
I remember it back then. I thought it looked dumb back then. So
I have to say, sometimes I wake up feeling like that look in the mornings.
There's also an appearance in this episode by the song Don't Bother None, except the lyrics never come in, which is a real shame. It's one of my favorites. It's about this scammer that ends up getting scammed herself. And the song also, I think, has some implied lesbian themes, which is very cool. It's just the lyrics aren't in the show. So check it out later.
In my notes, I actually lauded it for being an acoustic only interpretation, because we have heard it in the show before. And I found that the strumming and the drums came forward a little bit more with this really nice undertone, just this very simple scene of Spike tailing Giraffe and Giraffe tailing Wen.
It might be the only bebop song I can play on bass. As I noted on Twitter, the seatbelts were demons and extremely talented.
Some production notes this episode. Wen is voiced by Mona Marshall, who's best known as Izzy in Digimon, Tobaway in Wolf's Rain, and an extensive list of anime, cartoon, and video game credits. So thank you, Mona, for that very disturbing interpretation of the psychotic 12-year-old. This episode was written by Keiko Nobumoto, who also wrote 8 other episodes on the show. She also worked on Wolf's Rain, Space Dandy, and most recently Carol and Tuesday. And episode director Ikuro Sato worked on this one episode and was also an assistant unit director for the movie. Notable works of his include My Hero Academia, The Big O, and Eureka 7, in addition to the cartoon Inspector Gadget.
This episode ends with a through line revisited where Spike is asked, "Do you understand?" He does not. The dub version has him saying "as if," which is extremely 90s, and I'm not sure how that holds up, but the sentiment is still there. And the last line is bang.
So when I saw this episode in the early aughts, I actually thought that he did understand and he was sort of lying to himself maybe. Seeing it again, I realized, no, he really doesn't understand what Wen is talking about. He doesn't understand about he's finally at ease now. Spike doesn't understand it, and he doesn't understand it fully until that final episode. And that's what all that meant. And I never got that back in the day. I was just like, why is this here? I don't understand it. And now I think I get it.
Spike continually goes on about living a dream, and he says he's died once before. And it's true, he hasn't. He's still very much alive, and he's just in denial that he's living. I appreciate this episode opening with the cybernetic eye scene. We get some really spooky surgeons standing around with like glowing blue eyes. And on rewatch, I think that right eye looks very healthy. It's kind of startling that they're even operating on him at all. And this is a dream. It can be interpreted in many ways. There's a fish floating around in the eyeball tank. But it's very clear that Spike is traumatized by this eye in some way. And later on, we learn that his left eye sees the past. And the question is, then what does this right cybernetic eye see? Maybe it sees this dream constantly. Maybe it sees the future, or maybe it's enhanced in some way. And these are all questions that the show does leave up to interpretation, and we'll find out more about in upcoming episodes.
Seeing Spike as potentially living with and not healing from past trauma is something I don't think I've gotten the opportunity to do before this watch through. Having enjoyed WandaVision in its entirety, I think I am a lot more open to media being about that, and I'm excited to see that as a theme. Definitely only here in my 30s, though, have I experienced things like loss of loved ones and divorce that would actually make me understand what trauma is. That was way over my head when I was 14 or 17 or whatever it was.
This episode was pretty gruesome overall, too. They didn't air it, I believe, in Japan because of the scene being of a child being killed, or a depiction of a child being killed, themes of violence. On Adult Swim, when it aired, they changed out the impact of the bullet to the skull, and they also digitized out like Spike being half naked on the surgery table. And they delayed this in three other episodes in the wake of 9/11, given the obvious implications of a man falling out of a high rise and burnt corpses and things of that nature. So, yeah, this isn't an easy episode to watch or digest on many levels. And I don't think I had nearly that level of appreciation as a younger viewer.
So to that point, the burning question about the Netflix adaptation enters once again. Do you think this will be in the new show, or should it be?
Mary, you have opinions about this episode.
Should it be in the new series? I don't know. I would like to see if they were going to take these old stories, I would like for them to put their own spin on them. So maybe I think the right writer can make it work. But I can't say for sure this absolutely should be in. It's easily cuttable, I'll say.
I'm going to meta predict a little bit, and I'm going to say this will not be in the show. I would love for it to be. I would love to see the terrifying child actor they find to do this role, but I don't think they're going to. I have a theory as to why, and it's because I was hanging out on IMDb a couple days ago and noticed that at least on that channel, Julia and Vicious are credited with being in every episode. I don't know if that's actually going to happen or if that's just a rumor, but not every character is listed that way. We see Gren and some other side characters with lower numbers. And so my feeling is, if we're going to do a bunch of lore about, say, the explosion, the gateways, the migration off of Earth, they might tie that more in with Vicious and Julia and just the other overarching aspects of the show, if those characters are, in fact, in every episode.
So, Mary, did you have an episode you'd really like to see Netflix adapt?
Probably on that one, it would be Greenbird, I think. I don't think it's called Greenbird, but it's the one where the song Greenbird appears. See, I remember these through the music and not through the episode titles. I don't remember which episode it was, episode 5, I think, that Vicious first confronts Spike. I think that's a good one. I think that's really iconic. And I'd love to see that one and how they adapt it.
That
whole scene is beautiful.
That is Ballad of Fallen Angels. And I have to assume they're going there. What would be the point if we didn't do that?
I would be very angry if Vicious somehow got less screen time than he does in the anime.
If IMDb is to be believed, you will have a healthy serving of Sword Boy.
I'm going to say IMDb is not to be believed. I don't believe it. I think that they are more likely to do something where Vicious appears every once in a while, threaded throughout. Probably more often than he was in the anime, but I don't think he'll be in every episode. I'd be surprised.
We did have a discussion off mic that I just want to touch on, and that is whether or not we think there will be a season 2 of the Netflix show. And the fans believe that that is on the table because the actress who plays Faye was very specific about season 1 has finished wrapping. But I don't personally think that implies a second season. I think that is Netflix speak that they are like contractually obligated to adhere to leave the door open for something that might not be decided yet.
It's too early to call. I don't know. I go back and forth between, is this going to be a good adaptation? Should all this material be in there? Am I excited? Am I not? Last week and 2 weeks ago, I was like totally stoked and watching this episode. Like, how could they possibly encapsulate everything there is about that makes the show amazing into, you know, 10 episodes on Netflix? Maybe there'll be a season 2. Maybe they'll just leave it hanging. Maybe they'll do it dirty like they did Death Note. I don't know. I'm all over the place.
It's hard to say production schedule wise, too, because I did my whole podcast about She-Ra. And the funny thing about She-Ra was that they were making that show years in advance and they were done with it so far ahead of when it aired on Netflix that everyone going like, ooh, maybe people won't renew it because they hated it. It was too controversial. Like that conversation made no sense because it all already existed and for sure was going to air. We sort of knew behind the scenes that there was no question about it. But Bebop is clearly being filmed way closer to its air date than a cartoon was before its air date. Just Netflix things, guys. Just Netflix things.
Someone get a job at Netflix and tell me all their secrets. I need to know.
Well, I think that seems to be all we're going to dig up about Netflix so far today. Did anyone have any final thoughts on Sympathy for the Devil?
Wherever Fatty was eating desserts with Jet, I want to be there. Take me to that place. I want the entire 12 servings of desserts because they all looked amazing.
You're right. They did. We didn't mention poor Fatty very much. I felt really awful that character was named Fatty. I was really, really shaken by that. But, you know, I go back and forth on it because we don't know if maybe he named himself that. I'm known from my own father's time as a trucker and a motorcycle enthusiast that some people call themselves really interesting things and own it, but we don't know. And so as far as I'm concerned, it was just mean.
I'd like to step in here because I'm a fat person and I call myself fat. I wouldn't call myself Fatty, but I do feel a little bit weird about him, about Fatty. That's just one of the little off ones. That, along with Jet's sexist remark, are a little bit like, yeah, that was the 90s, wasn't it?
It truly was, especially with a line like, Lard Boy is in the way, like, woof, what a line, Spike.
Right.
Yeah, and that is not something that Fatty himself owned. That was just bullying. So maybe back off, you guys.
Agreed.
Yes. I'm with you on the desserts, though. I'm always up for eating multiple desserts in one sitting. A+.
There is a Netflix show called Kantaro, the Sweet Tooth Salaryman. I believe it's based on a manga. I did just finish watching it. So if you are also into watching food porn about Japanese desserts, this is a really cute take on a man who goes into mostly female dominated spaces to enjoy a plethora of desserts, much like how Patty and Jet did in that episode. And I looked, and pretty much everybody sitting in the cafe along with them are women. Just like, okay, Japan, thank you.
I know what show you're talking about, and food porn is honestly right, because his reactions are nothing short of fetish. Well, this sure went to a place.
It did.
Mary, thank you so much for being willing to come on to what I think is your very first podcast. Yes?
Yes, it is. And thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I feel incredibly honored and so special. Mary, if our listeners wanted to catch up on some of your latest projects or to learn about what you think is cool, what would you like to plug, or where should they go?
Well, I have something very close to my heart that I'd like to plug, and that is I foster cats. I'm currently fostering 3 little black cats. They're very sweet. It's hard to get people to want to adopt black cats, unfortunately. So we've had them for half a year at least. So if you would like, if you live in the North Texas area and you would like to adopt a cat, you'd like to save a life, go to animalalliesoftexas.rescuegroups.org. The cats that I'm fostering are named Liam, Vetra, and Cora. And if you are really generous, you will adopt all 3 of them because they're siblings. They were ferals that came up on our doorstep, and we captured them and we saved their lives. And we would really love for someone to give them all the love that they deserve. So that's the most important thing to me. If you want to talk to me or see what I have to say, don't think I'm that interesting. My Twitter is Cambiata, so you can look on Twitter, twitter.com/Cambiata, CambiAta. And that's where I'm at. You can talk to me. I'll talk to you back.
Mary, thank you again for being so generous with your time and joining us on the show today. I want to say on behalf of the Bebop Beat, we've made a donation of $50 to support ongoing web hosting fees. So we know it can be expensive, and we're so grateful that the resource is still there. We'll be using it for the remainder of the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
And get out there and adopt a black cat.
Yes, please do.
Our next episode is Heavy Metal Queen, and we have so many interesting things on the table for you. It's an episode about metal. It's an episode about trucking. It's an episode about a certain voice actress who had a really iconic role as VT. So we have lots of treats for you coming up, and we will hear from you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.